One of the some things that I had intended to do, I did it in my mind, so I thought that I had done it. Sometimes we do like that. So what I had wanted to do was write to Krishna Smarana before coming back and ask all of you to review what we had discussed so we could kind of reconnect again, because it's been some time. I meant to do that.
You should not do it this time. I didn't do it.
Yeah. Okay. So, gather your memories together and see if someone besides Krishna Smarana can volunteer. What was the subject matter that we were speaking about last time we were together? Think about it. Just take a good solid 15 seconds to think about it. What was the subject matter we were speaking about? You can even look at your notes, it's okay. Many of you have a petrified look on your face. That I might call on you and you don't know. It was related to the King Chitraketu story. Narada Muni, Angira Muni, King Chitraketu. Attachment, detachment. Bhakti. Looks like some lights went on. It's good. Good sign. I'll share two things with you before we get underway. An experience with Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada was amazing in many ways, and one of the amazing ways that he was amazing was, despite his incredibly demanding schedule of mega responsibilities, in Mayapur, he would do this regularly when he was traveling, but in Mayapur is when I had the experience of this. At a certain time in the afternoon, it was a regulated part of Prabhupada's schedule that he would hold a public darshan. So between 4:30 and 5:30, after lunch, little relaxing, and then before the evening program. So there's like, it's a nice peaceful time. He held darshan. And there were many devotees in Mayapur going to the festival, but for some reason, not so many people came for darshan. I was there every day. And the space was very small. It was just like this. Probably 500, 600 devotees in Mayapur. The temple room was packed, but the darshan room was about like this. So, every day, right at 4:30, I was right in the front row just to get Prabhupada's association. One day, Prabhupada, the rooms are adjacent where Prabhupada, where his I guess, you know, where his resting room is, and he had a little desk. And then he had the public reception room. Both their small rooms. But they served his purpose. In fact, he designed them. So he came from his personal private room to the darshan room. Everyone paid obeisances. Prabhupada sat down at the desk and just looked around the room, and he was maintained silence. And he maintained silence. And he maintained silence. And I don't know about everybody else, but I started getting uncomfortable because I realized that we were expecting the Prabhupada would entertain us in some way. Like, he's a television set, and we're the television viewer, and he was going to entertain us. And then I realized that's the relationship. It means that's the mindset. Our Guru Maharaj, he entertains us, and we sit and we get entertained. And that's not a very healthy, complete, full, dynamic relationship. He didn't even say, "So, any questions?" He just was silent. The silence was very powerful. It spoke volumes. So, from that personal experience, the verse 434 from Bhagavad Gita has always had more significance than it did before that experience. Tadvidhi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya upadekshantite jnanam jnaninastatvadarshanam. It's not a relationship with one who is a tattva-darshi is not a passive spectator type of relationship. It's not a one-way relationship. It's a give and take, love and trust relationship. It's a relationship. It's a two-way exchange. And another little personal comment is something that I used to do when visiting here, specifically at IIT Delhi, maybe a little bit different than at other places, particularly because of the audience. I would regularly begin classes by saying, "Okay, what did we speak about?" And similar to Prabhupada coming into the room, I got many blank faces until I started doing it on a regular basis. And then everybody got the idea, it's important that we retain what we hear, not just we get entertained and ask some questions and go, and our minds become blank again. But it's actually, the messages are meant to be understood. Shrinvanti gayanti grinanti sadavaha. They're meant to be assimilated, internalized. That's part of the relationship. Not just that you can recite it back, but you abide by those, you mold your life around those, you internalize those instructions. The Srimad Bhagavatam, it's how you, Seth Srut Maharaj wrote a book, Living with the Scriptures. So that's the idea. And the person who's a teacher of the Scriptures wants to do that in their life, and they want to share that part of their life with others, which means to live with the Scriptures. Not a secular notion. I read, I study, close that chapter, now I go off and go to the office or go to the lab or go to the classroom, close that office, come to Gaura Arati, close that chapter, go take some hot milk, go take rest, and then my life becomes a series of mechanical events that I do every day. And that's nice, we get regulated. But then, what about internalizing? So, this time around, not here at IIT, but I'm doing it now for because I've been thinking about it. I went to some of the other places I went. It was a surprise. I asked them, what did we speak about yesterday? Glass. Hello. No response. Hello. And so and then some persons volunteered some things, and I could understand from the response what to speak of internalizing. They hadn't so much gotten the essence of what the message was. Something obscure, something superficial, and something remote, and not the essence of the message. So I realized I hadn't done my service properly. And so this little exercise here with all of you, so I can at least better do my service properly. Service to Prabhupada and our acharyas, and relationship and assimilation of this knowledge. So give you these two examples would give you a little bit of idea where I'm coming from when I'm asking the question, what do we speak about? It's not just a recitation, regurgitation exercise. So, who can recall some of the things that we discussed? Could you say a whole sentence?
Can I read out somebody?
Well, I'd rather than have you read out, why don't you just say from your paraphrase, best of, what you can do.
These are material creation and material attachments, like me, my father. Father is due to material concoction.
Yeah.
And as long as we maintain these attachments, one can understand spiritual life. And one can understand Krishna.
Excellent.
And Nesvakti Yoga only gives detachment and attachment to Krishna. Detachment from material things and attachment to Krishna.
I would modify that a little bit. Yes, but modified a little bit. Did you all hear what he said? You couldn't hear what he said. You could? You could hear. Okay, thank you. and it relates to the verse that we're going to look at today. Before bhakti was presented, Angir Muni came alone. And he didn't present bhakti. He presented an experience and then knowledge that led to some detachment. Then detachment was made complete because of attachment through bhakti. There is a kind of detachment that comes from suffering. That's an understanding of why does God create this place where there's suffering. It's to help. It's not complete, but it's to help us become detached from the notion of enjoying separately from Him. It's not enjoyment. There's an expectation that never happens. In fact, the opposite happens. We suffer. There's a momentary sensation that gets smashed. Always. Sooner or later, it gets smashed. By design. That brings about a certain kind of detachment. But one of the themes of this whole sixth canto is unless and until, very standard phrase, something is necessary but not sufficient. That the hard experiences of life and the instructions that, about detachment that go along with that, in other words, karma and jnana, jnana can lead to vairagya, and suffering can lead to vairagya, but it's incomplete because the tendency for involving oneself once again is still in the heart. But it's not incomplete detachment can come from other things. The complete form of detachment is the form of attachment to the Supreme that comes through bhakti. So the lesson, I'm making this point because it's the main point of the verse that we're going to be covering. Okay, there's something else you want to contribute? That's enough for now. Anyone else out there?
That you mentioned was the difference between neutrality and indifference. That devotees are indifferent but not neutral. Like devotees are detached, but they still love, know how to love, because they center all the relations about the spiritual situation. In context, just in this contextual question that was asked to you by someone, that if everyone gets detached, then how will this world grow? And one more point, that
you're doing great, keep going.
That you mentioned was that the relation should be very friendly with other devotees, in context to that, like Angira Muni could only speak to Chitraketu only after he first of all cultivated his relation by giving him some benediction. So only after that he could give him transcendental knowledge. So the relationship is very strong.
Okay. A little modification. He not only he established a relation, but he did that which would allow Chitraketu to hear transcendental knowledge. He understood his nature, his psychophysical condition. He met him at that psychophysical condition. He didn't demand of him to come at once to a transcendental position. He related to him at the level where he, as the phrase goes, where he was at. He met him there and then brought him to the next position where he could hear. Because when they came back, Chitraketu was in such a state, he didn't even recognize who it was that had come. Right? And then when Chitraketu spoke again, he asked, "Who are you?" And then he said, "I'm the same Chitraketu who came here before. This time I came with my friend Narada." But so friendly, the modifier is that friendly relation or establishing a relation may mean meeting somebody at their level, connecting, and then after connecting, moving another step with them towards life's goal. A sub-point of that one is, that's taking a risk. Anytime a devotee extends themselves, or anybody extends, someone who's trying to be pure, extends themselves in that manner that I just described, that individual should recognize this is a risk. But it's... So one should not take risks beyond one's capacity to maintain purity, to not become infected. Like Prabhupada gives the example, the doctor goes into the disease-infested place, but he first takes an inoculation. So we need to be fortified and fixed and centered before we go into that situation. But establishing relationships with others, especially those who are trying to extend some compassion, those who are attached, it may... So both things have to be there. Maintaining strength, internal strength of Krishna consciousness, while externally extending ourselves on a level that the other person can relate to and accept, in order to bring them to another stage. And I would like to make a comment on the first point, that is, the difference between neutrality and indifference. So, where there's caring, this is another point of the one that I just made. In order that we don't fall into the trap of sentimentality and falling off the cliff, or of becoming infected by the diseased condition of those who we're extending our care and compassion to, one needs a strong connection, a strong spiritual connection. One's relationship with Krishna and Krishna's representatives must be strong. That's the inoculation. Then we can extend ourselves with genuine care and compassion and love. And without that strong connection, it's sentimental. We fall in the soup. Or another way of saying the same thing is real care and compassion and extending loving gestures to others is a spiritual act. Without the spiritual connection, it's a material act with material consequences both for the other person and for ourselves. Strong spiritual connection is essential. Or another way of saying the same thing is you can't give to somebody something you don't have. Or Krishna consciousness is not just an external event, either on the physical or mental plane. It's actually a spiritual state of consciousness. Without that spiritual state of consciousness, everything just becomes a wash of homogenized nothingness. There's no substance. There's categories, but no substance. And so the experience for both parties is no substance. There's no real exchange taking place. So the first business is this internalizing of our relationship with Krishna and Krishna's representatives. Then we can do so many things. Other. Yeah.
The wisdom from the mouth of the child is regarded. So, Ashoka also, in continuation to Yamuni and Narthamani, he also spoke on how he resolved to do mental concoctions. He was experiencing suffering. And then, three analogies he had mentioned of how.
The last part. Do the last part again.
Three analogies you have. Of how to extend this principle of mental concoction.
Okay.
looking peaceful anywhere and participating on the board.
Nice. What I'm tempted to do is I'll just ask you, your homework assignment is to think in practical terms, how can I apply any one of these things? Personally, today, or this semester, how can I apply some of all of this so that I can make a nice, firm step on the path of going back home, back to Godhead? Practical, personal. The reason for asking that question, I'll be explicit, is so that Krishna consciousness does not become another intellectual adjustment. Like Prabhupada speaks about the chanting of the holy name. It's not another imposition upon the mind. It's actually an awakening of the natural consciousness of the soul. Krishna, the chanting of the holy name. And when one is actually experiencing chanting of the holy name properly, it's not just like massaging and soothing and calming your mind. Shanti, shanti, shanti. Not just, you know, sedating your sympathetic nervous system. It's from the soul. The calling of the name is from the soul, and the action of the name upon living entity is on the platform of the soul, and the inclination to serve the Supreme Soul awakens. The natural feelings of wanting to serve the Supreme Lord in a joyous state for His pleasure. That's the real experience of the Holy Name. So, similarly, these instructions, living one's life as a servant of the Lord, how do I relate to other living beings, how do I relate to the dualities of being in a physical body, and the physical body placing demands of desires upon me as a soul, how do I deal with that properly as a devotee, as one who's trying to act in my relationship with Krishna? Very practical instructions. And practical instructions are meant to be practically applied. It's like spiritual intelligence. Dadami buddhi yogam tam. You know the verse from Bhagavad Gita? Who knows that verse from Bhagavad Gita? Our sloka raj here. What's the verse? Desham. Caught you sleeping. You know the verse. And the meaning, someone else. What is the meaning? The import of that verse. Those who are constantly engaged in devotional service to the Supreme Lord. What happens? Krishna recognizes that. Oh, how nice! He's always engaged. Satata yuktanam. Not only satata, bhajatam priti purvakam. Filled with loving affection for me. Ooh! Let me help him by giving intelligence, and a very special kind of intelligence. This how-to intelligence that everyone always asks about. How to do this, how to do that. The how to do that starts with satata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam. That's how to. Then Krishna gives. So these nice instructions, That's the intelligence. That's Krishna giving instructions. And we don't receive those instructions unless our heart is of that disposition. Bhajatam Priti Purvakam. Otherwise it's like, what do you call that? Hitting the ball against the wall, racquetball or something. Pow! Pow! Doesn't just keep bouncing against us, it doesn't go in. The instructions go in, it becomes part of your life. If Bhajatam Priti Purvakam, then from within. And same, the Bhagavatam is from without. The same super soul who gives those instructions from within very, very mercifully manifests externally as the Srimad Bhagavatam. Krishna's instructions are being spoken from without, and they're being spoken from without by Shukadeva Goswami, or one who has heard from Shukadeva Goswami, Suta Goswami, or one who has heard from Shukadeva Goswami, or in the cyclic succession. It's Krishna speaking. Tadami bhundi yogam tam yena mam upayanti te. How you can come to Krishna. How you can navigate your way through this network of material complexity and feel connected to Krishna at every step. So, many of you, if not all of you, will experience some form or another of what Chitraketu was experiencing. The desire to have a child, and the attachments that form from having the child, having family, and so even before that happens, and when that happens, and after that happens, there's different stages. One can receive instructions from Krishna in the form of the Srimad Bhagavatam, how to address yourself to that circumstance, how to be neutral but not callous, how to be connected to Krishna very strongly even while addressing the responsibilities of life, the various stages and the duties that go with those stages of life. Very practical. Dadami Bhuti Yogam Tam. Okay. So, do your homework. You know what the assignment is, right? You can go back and take a look at your notes and think of some other things that may have particularly strongly resonated with you and think, how can I apply this practically? Where we ended was Narada had given some prayers to Chitraketu to recite with the promise or with the prediction that within a week you're so ready for this, you're going to make very rapid advancement. You're detached and you're receptive. So here's some prayers, some stotras that you can recite. And by reciting them, you will meet the personality of Godhead in 7 days. Kind of a little different than what happened to Maharaj Parikshit. Within 7 days, you're going to meet the bite of a snake bird. But actually, for a devotee, that also meant leaving Maharaj Parikshit, leaving that body and going to Krishna. So for a devotee, either way, what seems to be punishment or what seems to be a benediction, they're both taken as an act of Krishna's mercy. And sure enough, that's what happened. So with the last prayer. Om Namo Bhagavate Mahapurushaya Mahanubhavaya Mahavibhuti Pataye. It's not in it's in prose, it's not in meter. So I'll read the translation. O Transcendental Lord, who are situated on the topmost planet of the spiritual world, your two lotus feet are always massaged by a multitude of the best devotees with their lotus bud hands. Now, he must have big feet. Unlimitedly big, because so many devotees are there massaging with their lotus bud hands. You are the supreme, but it's not a material kind of big. It's a spiritual kind of big. You are the supreme personality of Godhead, complete in six opulences. You are the supreme person mentioned in the Purusha Sukta prayers. So, the Bhagavatam is identifying, for those who might not be clear who the Purusha Sukta prayers are identifying, here it is. Not something impersonal. Sahasra Shirsha Purusha, Sahasraksha Sahasrapat. Impersonalists take that one way and devotees take that another way. You are the most perfect, self-realized master of all mystic power. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto you. In the purport, Prabhupada comments something that I'd like to expand upon a little bit. The devotees may sometimes, oh, go back. In the concluding, Sakala Sattvata Parivritta Nikarakara Kamala Kumandalo Palalita Charanaravin Yugala Parama Parameshtin Namaste. So in the verse, or in the prayer, there's a phrase Sakala Sattvata Parivritta. So Prabhupada breaks this down. Sattvata means devotees. Sakala means altogether. The devotees, who also have lotus feet, serve the lotus feet of the Lord with their lotus hands. The devotees may sometimes be not competent to serve the lotus feet of the Lord. And therefore the Lord is addressed as Parama Parameshtin. Parama Parameshtin is the topmost who is situated in the spiritual planet. He is the supreme person. But part of his supremacy is he is very kind to the devotees. Then Prabhupada says, concluding sentence, no one is competent to serve the Lord. But even if the devotee is not competent, the merciful Lord accepts the humble attempt of the devotee. I'll share with you something that from my visit after here, I went to Puri and spent some time preparing for the Puri Yatra and took part in the Puri Yatra. And I'll share with you what the strongest, like, something that I carried from that experience, and I plan to apply it. The many pastimes Chaitanya Mahaprabhu performed in Jagannath Puri, and they were very, very deep pastimes. And with his devotees, he performed various pastimes. And with those devotees, he drew them one by one in different, very wonderful ways. Very, very personal, very exciting ways. He took them deeper and deeper and deeper into the same mood that he was in. And he was in the highest stages of ecstatic love. And there's a certain characteristic about that ecstatic love. And his devotees exhibited it, and Mahaprabhu intensified those feelings too. Many, but I'm emphasizing two. Deep feelings of humility. And at the same time, great eagerness to meet with the Lord. Or, in a broader sense, great eagerness to achieve a spiritual objective. Now, both things are required to achieve, to advance in spiritual life. One requires humility, and one requires eagerness to achieve a spiritual goal. One without the other is incomplete. Consider someone that is very eager to achieve a spiritual goal, and they're proud. It's inconsistent, isn't it? Someone that either presents themselves or is presented by others or is a very enthusiastic, aspiring spiritualist and is proud. They're not going to go very far, and it's a farce. The other way also, someone is very, very humble, and they lose sight of the spiritual goal. What's that? Something's wrong. Something's missing. It's a material conception of humility, or a material application of what may be something that's sincere and genuine humility, but without the spiritual goal, it ends up in the mode of ignorance. Lamentation, moroseness, self-pity, me, self-indulgence, and the lamentation platform. Just hanging out with the mode of ignorance and wallowing in it. So, but these two, look at it, step back and think, if you're feeling, if you have a very realistic, which is a humble conception of oneself, humility is the conception that one has of oneself, or its opposite is egoism, inflated ego. So what I think of myself in relation to God, he's very great, I'm very small. That's a spiritual conception so far. The connection is, therefore, I should serve him. Prabhupada said, Krishna consciousness is very simple. God is very great. I am very small. Therefore, I should serve him. That is Krishna consciousness. Then Prabhupada would say, how great God is, that they do not know. He liked to use that phrase. That they do not know. Because if you do know how great God is, oh, let me serve him. There has to be a spiritual conception. Otherwise, if I have a material conception, I'll be envious. Why should he be so great? He's not so great. Look at this fault, look at that. Material intelligence applies material conceptions to not understand the exhibition of spiritual potencies. That's the position of scholars who in their heart hold envy rather than understanding how great he is. Or materialists, or atheists, or whatever. So, the spiritual conception of oneself is a conception of humility. And using Prabhupada's language in the purport, feeling not competent, feeling not qualified, feeling, and so it's recognizing and the feelings connected with that recognition. What qualification do I have to serve the lotus feet of the Lord? Take a look at me. Take an honest look. Let me take an honest look at myself, and what qualification is there? Or minus? That's humility. So one who's feeling humility without a spiritual conception and the spiritual conception of God, then here's another rule of thumb definition. Something material decreases devotional service. Something spiritual increases devotional service. If I have a material conception of humility, that means I can't serve Krishna because I'm not competent. I'm filled with faults. I have so many shortcomings. I have so many contaminations. Whoa, 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 singing the blues. Lamenting. The spiritual conception of that kind of humility gives rise to, since I am in this condition, I must try double hard, triple hard, 10 times as hard as anyone else to compensate for the fact of how fallen I am. And my trying is not going to be sufficient either. I need some descending mercy. But just see, the Lord who I'm serving, that Master who I'm taking shelter of, he is so compassionate that he'll accept that service. That's what Prabhupada is saying in this little paragraph that I just read. Therefore, how eager I am to serve him. Because I don't want to stay in this contaminated, incompetent, fault-ridden, shortcoming, infested condition of life. I don't want to stay here. I want to achieve the shelter of the Lord. Because he's so merciful. Aha! Because of his superlative quality, he'll help me. Because without that, finished, rot in the material world. Very important. The little statement that Prabhupada has made here. It's right within the prayer that Narada gave to King Chitraketu. It's a prayer that brings very great clarity to his humble position and intensifies the mood of service because of the spiritual conception of the qualities of the personality of Godhead. There's a very nice example of this, often quoted, ecstatic example of this when Vidura meets Uddhava in the third canto of the Bhagavatam. Uddhava, I haven't even started on the verse for the morning. It's okay, we'll do it later. Uddhava was told by Krishna and Dwarka, my pastimes are over. I'm going to leave. Yes, I'm going to leave. And I want you to be safe and protected. You're going to leave? Yes, I want you to be safe and protected. Go to the sages of Naranarayan Rishi. Go into the Himalayas and take shelter of them. Be always with them, because after I leave, Kali Yuga is going to start in full swing, and it's not nice. And I don't want you to have to suffer the pangs of Kali Yuga. So stay always in good devotee association. Go. So it was very difficult for him to go, depart from the Lord, but the Lord was giving him the order. So with pain in his heart, he left, heading for Haridwar. And the Lord left Dwaraka and went into the forest for his pastimes of departing this world. Uddhava couldn't bear it. He didn't even make it to Haridwar. He just stopped and went searching for the Lord. And he searched for the Lord, and he searched for the Lord, and he searched for the Lord, and couldn't find him. Such pain of separation. He found him. Beautiful description. Under a large banyan tree, the Lord was leaning against the banyan tree with his long arms stretching down to his knees. Beautiful lotus eyes. Very serene countenance. Body darkish like a monsoon cloud. Uddhava came running and fell before the Lord. And the details of what took place is described later in the 11th canto, the Uddhava Gita. That's where that section took place. Maitreya was present and he heard the conversation between Uddhava and Krishna. And then after long exchange, again, Krishna separated from Uddhava. Later, Vidura met Uddhava. Oh, you were just with the Lord. Please describe the personality of Godhead. Uddhava was in such an ecstatic state, or the state of feelings of separation and feelings of love at the same time. He couldn't speak. Just due to his feelings of ecstasy, he couldn't speak. And then he finally spoke something. And the something that he spoke was this: how merciful is my Lord? Everyone must serve someone. And who can there be a better person to serve than Krishna? And he gives the example of Putana. He is such a master. Putana came to kill him. Krishna overlooked that she was trying to kill him, but that she had some maternal affection in her heart also. That is what he accepted, the maternal affection in her heart, and gave her position in Goloka Vrindavan after he drew her life air out of her body as a mother to assist Mother Yasoda in Goloka Vrindavan. Now I ask you, who can be such a merciful master as Krishna? Uddhava was an ecstatic devotee. Very, very high platform of not only realization, but deep, deep, deep transcendental feeling. Therefore I should serve him. He is so great. And what is the one aspect that Uddhava was appreciating of his greatness? His merciful aspect. He sees the service. It's not that he doesn't see the other, but whatever little mood of service we have, Krishna accepts and reciprocates with in such a strong manner. So, although we may be very diminutive, tiny, and in this language of this purport, not competent, the Lord accepts our service. Particularly he accepts our service if that service is under the shelter of one who is guiding one in spiritual life. Krishna does not so much like people that try to approach him directly. In Adi Purana, Krishna says, one who claims to be my devotee, he's not my devotee. But one who is the devotee of my devotee, that is my devotee. How many times in Bhagavad Gita is the phrase used under the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master? How many times? When a great acharya like Srila Prabhupada repeats something, what to speak of so many times, we should understand this is very important. When Krishna sees that we're taking shelter under the guidance of a qualified person to instruct us, that's more pleasing to Krishna than directly trying to approach him, worship his deity form. If we approach the deity form, it's under the direction, under the guidance, as training and assistance to become pure, not something direct, something that is through the medium of. And same, applying Krishna consciousness in our lives. Prabhupada once said to the devotees in America, young American devotees, he knew his audience, he knew his disciples. He said, you're all thinking, and I'm saying this specifically for your benefit also, you also may be thinking, because of my piety, I am here. Because of my piety, I have nice intelligence. I'm at the best institute of higher learning here in India. I have such piety that I'm also attracted to nice teachings in Bhagavad Gita. On the strength of my piety, I am here. Prabhupada said, I know you're thinking like that, but it is not like that. The reality is, I found each and every one of you in some dark place, and I've grabbed you by the hair on your head, and I'm dragging you to a spiritual position. And all the while, you're kicking and fussing and flailing. That's the reality. I'm dragging you to Krishna. That is the fact. That you should understand. Now, no doubt, there is certainly some piety for someone to be attracted to any spiritual activity, but to come to the spiritual reality that the Bhagavatam is speaking about, that is, factually making the connection between ourselves and the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and like the comment that was made over here, this the platform of detachment will be consummated through those great, great, great efforts, not only of the instructions, but the enormous amount of assistance that we're getting, like Angira with Chitraketu, going through with us so many experiences of our attachments leading to suffering, and at those moments of suffering because of the relationship, the application of relevant instructions to help us become detached, not just from the suffering, but from the root of the suffering. The identification with the material experience itself. The expectation of enjoyment through contact of the senses with the sense objects that I am now entitled to because I have piety. It's illusion. And trying to enjoy a dream. Wake up! It's a dream! Wait a minute, I'm enjoying the dream. I don't want to wake up. We've all experienced it as persons trying to help others in Krishna consciousness. So there's a very, very powerful dynamic that's being expressed here in these prayers and in this whole exchange between Narada, and before that, Angira. Chitraketu was madly attached. So we may not be so madly attached, but certainly attached. So the instructions are very, very relevant. How to get on the other side of attachments? Ideally through good instructions, but it may also involve some suffering because of our unwillingness to let go of our attachments. And then a willingness to internalize those instructions. Then you become completely freed. Because this is the whole canto, how to become freed even from the tendency, not even just the prarabdha, the karma, of one's past activities and attachments to trying to be the enjoyer of our past activities. But albeit doing it piously. That's, in the Bhagavatam language, that's kind of a dharma. And rather, in the Bhagavatam language, Bhagavat Dharma replaces that. And this narration about King Chitraketu is to help us understand the principles of Bhagavat Dharma beyond the principles of piety and happily, in the mode of goodness, to some degree at least, trying to be the enjoyers of the fruits of our piety. The message of the Bhagavatam is to become freed from that, which is yet another bondage to the cycle of birth and death. It's an impediment on the path of bhakti. Understanding that lesson, I remember the last time I was here, I shared this with you, and then one more time. That's an important lesson for all of you to learn. Krishna consciousness, the message of the Srimad Bhagavatam is not yet another kind of piety. Like chanting of the holy name is an offense against the holy name, to consider the chanting of the holy name to be one of the karmakanda-like rituals offered in the Vedas as a means of elevation to a higher, an upgrade of being happy, at least perhaps being freed from some of the suffering of being involved in material life. So I can parallel involving myself with material life and chant Hare Krishna and suffer less. That's an offense against the holy name, and it's a misunderstanding of what the message of the Bhagavatam is also. So if you understand the message of the Bhagavatam, it will help us overcome that offense in chanting. I hope you heard that message. Okay, so the 7:30 bell rang 10 minutes ago. If those of you that have classes and have to move on, please feel free to do so. Those that would like to stay and ask some questions can do so. Yes.
You were saying that one must surrender to the Shri. That surrender must also be from a spiritual perspective. So, one cannot surrender unless one knows the actual spiritual position of the various teachers.
That's right.
So, how can we recognize?
Let me reinforce what you just said by something that Prabhupada said. Once Srila Prabhupada was asked that you are always speaking about the importance of surrendering to a bona fide spiritual master. How do we know who is a bona fide spiritual master? How do we know whose translation of Bhagavad Gita we should be accepting? Prabhupada confirmed that the value of that question by saying that this is very good. There has to be some preliminary understanding. He gave the example. When you go to the marketplace and you want to buy a diamond, so many persons will try to sell you cut glass, not a diamond. And so you have to have some preliminary knowledge. what a diamond is, what cut glass is, and how they're different. Now, he didn't in that particular conversation, he didn't delineate what are some of the different properties. But I could share with you what one of the different properties is. Glass will not cut glass, but a diamond will cut glass. You take the diamond and scratch it across the surface of glass, and it'll cut the glass. The diamond is harder, the glass will be cut. You won't damage the diamond. So, I know one devotee, who's Tamal Krishna Maharaj, because his disciple Kastuba was saying, he went to buy a watch and asked, you know, is this a crystal or is it glass? He said, oh, it's crystal. So he took it, he put it on the counter and started to, like he was making a motion, like he was going to scratch it on the counter and watch the man's face to see if, no, you ruined the glass. But if it's crystal, it won't scratch. It won't scratch the glass. So Kastuba was appreciating, this was the streetwise smarts of his spiritual master. That he knew how to, he had that preliminary knowledge. Now, whether it was glass or crystal, without testing, you wouldn't know. So there has to be some, it's the responsibility of a disciple to have some preliminary knowledge. And then as one goes along, that preliminary knowledge will be expanded, reinforced, filled in much greater detail, and so on. So one of the standards that Prabhupada has given again and again is one who's coming into Siddhic succession. That's a preliminary. So one should examine. Is this individual speaking in accord with the disciplic succession? Which means, let's say, the practical application of that would be one has to read Prabhupada's books. I would, you know, at a further stage, one can read the writings of other acharyas within our line to see if Prabhupada's books are consistent with the writings of the predecessor acharyas. But just even the initial stage, read Prabhupada's books, listen carefully to the person who is teaching, and are they teaching according to Prabhupada's books? Or is there significant discrepancy? Not just a detail, but a principle that's just off. Then there's one set of criterion. Then another set of criterion is their personal life consistent with what they teach? Is there duplicity? Say one thing, do another thing. Practically speaking, here you have that opportunity. Krishna Smarana and Krishangi live in a fishbowl. Their private lives are known by everybody. What they do, along with what they say, is perfectly known. So there's plenty of opportunity to evaluate. Are they, what they're speaking, consistent with what they do, or what they do consistent with what they speak? The teachings they give. It's another criterion. Another criterion is there detachment? That's an indication of attachment to Krishna. Are they exhibiting the qualities of a devotee, at least the qualities of goodness? Sama, Dhammak, Tapak, Shocham, Shantir, Arjavam, Evacha, Jnanam, Vijnanam, Astikyam. Is that present? And aside from the qualities of goodness, the qualities of devotion. That they're always, in Prabhupada's words to John Lennon, and ask the same question, what makes your translation of Bhagavad Gita one that I should read? Prabhupada's answer was, one who always speaks about Krishna, they're always acting for Krishna, they're always glorifying Krishna. In fact, their whole life, 24 hours a day, it's nothing but Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. That person. Again, you can see in practical terms about in the lives of so individuals that you're hearing from. And it doesn't mean that they're perfected beings. It doesn't mean they must be uttama adhikaris. It does mean that they're practically following. Whatever their realization is, we may not have the capacity to understand, but we can understand without unflinchingly they're on the path. And that path leads to Krishna. And they're giving Krishna, giving Krishna, giving Krishna. Those are some criteria. Okay. Anything else? Yes.
This, because of the fluctuating mind, that determination to follow sometimes lessens. How fixed up.
A teaching that Prabhupada gave about increasing determination, there's several points, but one of them that's real easy to understand and real easy to apply is practicing sense control. In a lecture series that Prabhupada gave in Los Angeles, on the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. The series is called The Perfection of Yoga. It's the sixth chapter because the final verse is the practice of Shraddhavan Bhajate Yomam Same Yukta Tamo Mataha. The practice of devotional service with great faith is considered to be the highest. So in reading the sixth chapter, Prabhupada was address this question. The question was asked, how can one increase one's determination? Prabhupada's answer was by increasing one's austerities or the voluntary control of the senses. Like, for example, yesterday was Ekadasi. And we have the opportunity twice a month to observe Ekadasi, and we can observe Ekadasi very carefully. And there are different gradations of observing Ekadasi in terms of austerities that we might observe. And one should not try to observe austerities that are artificial. But if we are striving to intensify our determination and our concentration upon Krishna, there's a great opportunity because it's Vaishnava, it's Vedic, and it's a Vaishnava occasion for decreasing our bodily demands and increasing our concentration upon Krishna, increasing our hearing and chanting. And with that increased concentration on hearing and chanting, on that auspicious day of Ekadasi, awakening our bhakti. So there's one example. Another of application of working to control our senses. Another is how carefully you regulate your day-to-day life. Resting early, rising early, bathing, and carefully attending to those activities which will give purity and regularity. You know, increase the qualities of goodness in our life. That will also help concentration or determination. That's on one end. You know, on the control of the disturbances, and you minimize the disturbances by being more in the mode of goodness and more concentrated in the spiritual objective. So on the spiritual objective side, the more you clearly identify the goal, the more you can be determined to reach it. Right? Like supposing somebody comes to school, this happens in America a lot, someone's got an entrance into college and I ask them, what are you majoring in? I haven't decided yet. Okay, that sometimes can happen. They haven't yet defined. But some people don't seem to get it together to define what they want to. So because they're not clearly identified on the goal, they're not greatly determined to reach it either. Supposing I say, I like to travel. Well, what kind of places do you like to travel to? I just like to travel. I get in my car and drive around, and I get in a plane and fly around, and get in a train going anywhere. And get in my bicycle and just go for a ride. But if you have a very clear sense of goal, Prabhupada taught this, when you have a clearly defined goal, it's very easy to traverse to the goal, to achieve that goal. So that connects with this. You have a clear understanding of the merciful nature of Krishna. It can make one very determined, I want to be with Krishna. I don't want to become the servant of some imperfect and merciless master. I want Krishna to be my master. I may have to be in some employment situation with such a person, but he's not my master. Krishna is my master. I aim to please Krishna. And I'm not going to budge an inch from that one. I'm very clear, very determined, because I know what the goal is. He is the goal of my life. Then disturbances may come, and I can remain undisturbed because the goal is very clear. It's just another part of duality. Sometimes it's nice and sometimes it's unpleasant. It doesn't change one fraction, one particle of my determination. I know exactly what the goal is. Symptoms of a humble person. I'm going to give a 3-day seminar that's one of the major topics. So I'm just thinking. Whew. I'll repeat two things that I said earlier this morning, just to reinforce them. In relation to Krishna, a humble person understands their insignificance. And a truly humble person has a very strong mood of service. But that mood of service is not a boastful, loud, look at me, how I'm serving disposition. The person who is humble that humility itself is more powerful than boastfulness. they're very honest with themselves and they're honest with others because of that humility. There's no, what's the word? Deception. They're clear. They're honest. Because they're humble. They're not looking for some shelter of some deceptive conception of themselves or putting forward deceptive conception about themselves to others for any reason, for effect or for acceptance or for praise or honor. Or they don't care for those things. In fact, quite the opposite, a humble person is not wanting to draw attention to themselves. A nice example of that is Madhavendra Puri. When Madhavendra Puri received the pots of sweet rice from Gopinath, you know that pastime, he immediately left after taking the sweet rice and breaking the pots and placing them in, tied up in his cloth so he could eat a little bit every day. It's another symptom of humility, is when one receives mercy, one very, very deeply appreciates it. That's the sign of humility. Because what is my qualification, and yet some mercy is coming? How grateful I feel. But another is they don't want to draw attention to themselves. He left because he knew when the people of Ramuna come to know that Gopinath kept these pots of sweet rice for me, then they'll want to come and see the sadhu. I don't want that. He left to avoid public attention, not wanting to draw attention to himself. But what he wanted to do was complete the mission that his deity Gopal had given to him. That's the mood of service. Wanting to please my master in a humble mood. Not to draw attention to myself, to draw attention to him, to give satisfaction to him. Consistently, like that. I'll add to that. In the first chapter of this sixth canto, there's a description given by Jiva Goswami in one purport about two categories of bhakti. One category of bhakti is that which is unceasing, santata, and the other is intermittent, kadachit ki, sometimes then slackens, sometimes then slackens. In the intermittent devotional service, there's three stages, three subcategories. At the bottom stage is abhas, just a shadow. The intermediate stage is where one just likes the position of serving. That's a symptom of humility. That symptom of humility gives rise to another, yet another stage of humility, and that is a great anticipation for encountering the mercy of the object of my service. Although I feel myself unqualified, still I can't restrain myself. I want that mercy from them. It's a symptom of humility. enthusiasm is a symptom of humility. Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes this in his commentary on Nectar of Instruction, Upadesh Amrita, when the quality of Utsahan is commented upon by him. His commentary says, same point, in order for there to be genuine enthusiasm, there must be genuine sustained enthusiasm, not the intermittent based on passion, pursuing a fruitive goal. If I get it, my enthusiasm desists. If I don't get it, my enthusiasm desists. But one that's sustained, and sustained enthusiasm requires or is based upon a spiritual conception. One who has a spiritual conception is humble. In a spiritual conception, my existence is, I'm a tiny fragmental spark. Tiny. But that's nice, because it's a position of service. And for that service, I'm very enthusiastic. So that's a symptom of humility. Although it may seem, back to this other point that I was making, it may seem contradictory. Somebody who's humble should be just like cowering and holding their head down and being humble, right? Enthusiastic. That's humility. Enthusiastic to serve Krishna. And detachment from anything that is unrelated to serving Krishna. These are spiritual conceptions of what humility is. So it gives rise to attachment to Krishna. Then that gives rise to spontaneous, ecstatic feelings, which deepen one's sense of humility. That is, how great is Krishna? I'm getting not only an understanding, but a realization. Oh, Krishna! One's humility becomes more intense. It's nice. It's a prerequisite for spiritual advancement to be humble. But mind you, I'm putting the qualifier in. With the spiritual application of that feeling of being so insignificant, or connecting it with the expressions of service. And not just as an intellectual adjustment, but an actual happiness, contentment to be in a position of serving. Last comment is that Prabhupada, my training in Krishna consciousness was this, as far as living in student life, as all of you are living in student life. Prabhupada's teaching was, one who is actually in that stage of life, the training is such that one who is rightly situated in that student life is very contented with a life of simplicity, cleanliness, sacrifice of the hearing process. Specifically, that's a brahmacharya or a student position. And some service, whatever, humble, menial service. A little prasad, a little space to lie down at night. And Prabhupada's expression was, when one lies down at night and one considers, I'm very satisfied. Contentment. in that position. So that's another humility. Or the converse is one who is not humble. They're anxious for something else. They're anxious for something material. So they're not carrying a spiritual conception. I want. There's some insufficiency. It's pinching. My mind becomes restless. I can't study properly. I can't hear properly. I can't maintain a disposition of humility. When somebody doesn't respect me, I get really aggravated. And if I don't snap back at them, I want to, and I carry it with me all day or for days. That's lack of humility. I think I'm going to end because it's late. Okay. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada.